A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 14, 2002, in the series Spiritual Life, Religion Reimagined, entitled Dropping the Salvation Fantasy. The texts for the sermon are Psalm 131 and John 3, verses 1 through 10. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I begin this morning a brief series of messages on the spiritual life, reimagining religion. The connection between the two is this: they are not the same, but religion provides the form and the structure for the expression of one's spiritual life. And I believe it's good to think about that and to perhaps make an attempt to reimagine that religion, because religious forms and structures can aid and abet the expression of our spiritual life, or hinder and block, causing the spirit to wither. And so from time to time, it's good to ask ourselves about our religious practice, our religious experience, the structures and the forms that we utilize in the expression of our spiritual life. Thomas More's book, Spirituality for the Soul, or something like that, I've got it on my desk, I've been reading it, looking at it day after day after day, and I can't remember the title, but it's new. It was a trigger for this. Some years ago, he wrote The Care of the Soul, which impressed me a great deal. And I like this book too. Not so much that I intend to share what he speaks of there, but it's the format. He speaks autobiographically. And as I was reading his own story, I was reminded of my story and the fact that there's a great similarity in that he was deeply rooted in the Roman Catholic tradition, coming to the point of ordination to priesthood when he left the church. And so deeply traditioned as he was, he's never been able to get it out of his soul, nor has he wanted to. But the form and the structure, the institution, could no longer be for him the vehicle by which he could express the spirituality of his life. And as I thought about his own autobiographical expression, I began to think about mine. And, well, I've spoken for a long time about being in the springtime of my senility, but I've spoken about it so long that I suppose I should confess that I'm well into the summer of it now. So rather than trying to remember these things, because the more I thought about it, I got quite a list. These 8 transformations in my own pilgrimage, my own experience. And I share them with you not because you're so interested in mine, but because as I do this, perhaps I can do for you what Thomas More did for me, cause you to think, where have I been? Where have I moved? Where have I come to? And where am I going? Well, this is my story. This is my list. I've come from a conservative orthodoxy to a liberal openness. I've moved from a supernatural theism to a religious naturalism. I've moved from religion as verifiable truth to religion as experience of the sacred dimension of all of reality. I've moved from religion as dogma to religion as poetry, from religion as institution to religion as community, from religion as consisting of absolute truth to religion as emerging experience, from Christianity as exclusive to Christianity as one magnificent window opening on the holy and the sacred. And finally, I've moved from religion as salvation from damnation to religion as celebration of life. That's quite a journey. I've made a slight course adjustment. Some might say that's 180 degrees, and I would have to agree. And most people who have gone through that kind of a transformation, most Christian leaders, or religious leaders, I should say, have simply left the institution. And they've left the institution probably as an expression of honesty and their own integrity, being no longer able to profess, to affirm the institution's form and structure and faith, creedal statement. They simply have left the institution as it was. And of course, there are others who have been invited to leave the institution because their views were judged to be heretical. And I've been very fortunate. And I think my experience has been a rather rare experience, and that I have been able to continue the spiritual quest, continue to wrestle and struggle with the faith within a community, because you have joined with me, you have gone with me on this journey. Some of you kicking and screaming all the way. Some of you relieved because you were already there before I was. And some of you, frankly, just sort of watching from the sidelines, not really engaged. But whatever may be the case, I have had the rare privilege of being out of the institution, but not out of a community that is a continuing spiritual community on a journey, on a spiritual quest. And thank God for that, because I'd starve otherwise. I'm of no practical good for anything else. But more than that, it is the passion of my life to create a community for that narrow niche of people who have gone through the same kind of transformation that I have and have doggedly refused just to throw in the towel and to give up on the spiritual life. And so it's with a great deal of gratitude that I recognize, having gone through such a transformation, that there still is a community in which I can engage, in which we can engage together on the spiritual quest, with the freedom to reimagine religion and to bring our understanding of religion more into conformity with our general human experience. And this is a wonderful time to be doing this, because we are in a time between the times. Maybe that's always true to some extent, but it certainly is true in this period of history through which we are living. And it has been going on for some time, and I don't know when something will gel out in the future. But we're in a time between the times. Those who study the philosophical development and religious theological development, the history of ideas, do a job of periodization. And they'll speak of the ancient world and then perhaps the medieval world. And that medieval world included the Reformation world in which my particular brand of faith was honed. And then there was modernity, the last three and a half centuries, the modern period. And we've spoken about that many times, the rise of critical thinking, the empirical method of verification, giving rise to all the natural sciences. And in the 19th century, the rise of historical consciousness and the sense of everything developing, the whole evolutionary, cosmic, emerging drama. And modernity presented a tremendous challenge to the old orthodoxy, to the age of faith, so to speak. And so that we're at a time now, a time between the times. Modernity has been around long enough, and there are those who speak about post-modernity today. That's another story I won't get into. But let me simply say, modernity has been around long enough so that its challenge has been severe enough that we have in our world today a reaction. And that reaction we speak of as fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is a reaction to the threat to religious forms and structures and creedal statements that is brought on by critical rationality, by scientific discovery of the nature of reality, of historical development, etc. And the fundamentalist is one who reacts against that because he feels threatened by that. Because a religious community is really a cultural, linguistic community. We have our own language, our own vocabulary, our own forms, and our own structures, our own rituals. And as long as we operate in that little circle, we're comfortable. And it triggers for us meaning. Baptism triggers for us meaning. The Lord's Supper, the scripture read, prayers, hymns, all of that. And there's certain vocabulary that is used, certain phraseology, etc. And that community is comfortable with that. Now, you begin to analyze that. You begin to take that apart. And it becomes scary. Because our meaning and our life is tied up in that cultural, linguistic complex of things. And so, when that begins to be threatened, the fundamentalist is born. And someone has defined a fundamentalist as one who reiterates yesterday's answers to today's questions. And what happens is that religious experience then becomes more and more disconnected from everyday experience. Because out in the world of business, the world of industry, the world of the arts, philosophy, education, whatever you might say, that world goes on. New knowledge brings new methods, new breakthroughs, new technologies. And we enter into that, whether we're fundamentalists or not. Fundamentalists fly in jet airplanes, and there's no way my religious community and my religious commitments are going to keep me from being a part of the rest of the world. But my religious experience in that case becomes more and more disconnected from that. Becomes a compartment of my life rather than watering the whole flow of my life. And so the fundamentalist reaction today is a recognition that we're in a time between the times. The old is dying. And the old is dying. I did my devotion yesterday with the Grand Rapids Press, as I always do on Saturday morning, in order to find some fodder to preach or whatever, something to get excited about or angry about. And I'm usually successful. And I'm thinking about all of this stuff, and then I read this big article about how the mainline denominations, all of them, have commissioned a survey. They've commissioned a survey about how to grow again, which means a survey about how to survive, because they all know they're dying, because they've all experienced significant membership loss. And I could have told them what they found out with a lot less cost. It was that you need leaders who are innovative and creative and who are persistent in their purpose. But they decided they can no longer deal simply, they can't build churches simply for waspy folks like us. They have to go after racial groups, ethnic groups, minority groups, etc. Well, I wonder why there's still enough waspy folks around. The crisis is they're asking the wrong question. Why are people dropping out? Why are there thousands less people today than there were 10 years ago? Is the issue for the church survival? Is it to try to figure out how you can hold on, hang on? Or ought the institutional forms be such open, flexible, fluid, and free that they can shape around where life is moving? But on the back page of the same article, of the article, was a story about the Lutheran, Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor who participated in Rudy Giuliani's request to have a prayer service in the Yankee Stadium after 9/11. Do you remember the story? Yankee Stadium was full, and there was a Christian and a Jew and a Hindu, and they had a service in which they sang God Bless America and prayers were offered for the nation. And this Lutheran pastor, who participated as a Christian, is about to be ousted from the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church because his participation in that service might give the impression that there are other gods or other ways to God. So you see, that kind of thing, well, that's atrocious, isn't it? If you're thoughtful, if you're sensitive at all, you would say, such an institution really deserves to die because it is mindful of its own life, its own particularity, with a kind of absolutist closeness and exclusivism that a thoughtful, sensitive, intelligent person could not honestly affirm in our world, in our day. The old institutional forms are dying. We're in a time between the times when the old is dying. I don't know how long it'll take. Maybe there'll be another blush of triumph in another 100 years or so, but the old institutional forms are dying. But the other reaction to the whole movement of modernity is one of modern atheism or agnosticism or just simply the writing off of the spiritual life as though one was an animal, an animal, an animal. The extreme expression of that is nihilism, that there is no meaning. Nothing means nothing. And the nihilist would simply say that this whole cosmic drama, just a chance accident unwinding, who knows where, and certainly for no purpose, with no meaning whatsoever. And there are hordes of our contemporaries who, without consciously saying, I'm a nihilist, are living a nihilist existence, barren of any kind of transcendent dimension in their life. T.S. Eliot wonderful poem, The Wasteland, his poetic commentary on modernity, speaks about the great Western religious symbols as a heap of broken images. That's where it is for a lot of people. The tragedy with the eruption of critical thinking and the scientific method and the whole rise of modernity, the tragedy was that religious people were threatened, and so they fought it. And there were those in the scientific community who affirmed that what they were dealing with was all there was, and there was a hubris, a pride on that side. And so many who were thoughtful, intelligent, simply left. In the West, the intellectual elite has left institutional religion, whether or not they've continued in some kind of personal spiritual pilgrimage. We're in a time between the times when, on the one hand, there's a shrill fundamentalism that is afraid because it's losing its grip, and a barren spirituality that lives just a little bit above an animal existence. So it's a wonderful time to be thinking about this. And where do we go? Well, I suggest in the title we drop the salvation fantasy. Just drop the salvation fantasy. What do I mean by the salvation fantasy? Well, I mean that God's a creator, that he created humankind perfectly, that humankind was tested, failed the test, came under the curse of God's wrath, and stands in threat of eternal damnation, except that God provided in Jesus Christ the atoning death, taking our sin and guilt, therefore offering forgiveness for those who repent and believe, and therefore heaven assured. That's the story. That's the myth. And I don't care whether you take the lilting liturgy of the Anglican community or the passionate address of evangelist Billy Graham or the rumblings of TV evangelist Jerry Falwell. Down deep, that's the story. That's the myth. That's what's being talked about. It may be talked about in sophisticated tones, or it may be talked about in down and dirty, blunt language, but that's what it's about. And I'm suggesting that we ought simply to give it up. Give up the idea that God somehow or other created a creature, put it to the test, and then failing the test, will damn it, unless there is repentance, faith, etc., etc. What the picture of God, that makes God a monster. And the picture of humankind is degrading. We are not God-damned creatures. We are animals emerging out of the jungle with all of the survival instincts hanging on to us, and also something more that lifts up our eyes and lifts up our hearts and beckons us beyond where we are. Something that says to us that what we see is not all there is. We are magnificent creatures. Are we lost? Oh my God, we're lost? Of course we're lost. We're trying to find our way. That's really what the whole religious quest is all about, the spiritual quest, trying to find our way. Who are we after all? But it's not as though God is angry with us, alienated from us. We're just simply lost. And salvation, of course, salvation, that's the root, that word has its root in salve. It means healing. Do we need salvation? Of course we need salvation. We are a blind and lost people, barren in our spiritual life and confused and disoriented. Do we need help? Dear God, we need help. But that's exactly what the invitation is of the God who would never abandon us, the God who embraces us, the God who calls us into a web of meaning, not a God out there somehow or other, but that sacred and holy dimension which is in us and beyond us, which binds us together in a web of meaning and relationship. And, well, you might be surprised that dropping the salvation fantasy should have as its text being born again. But I think of old Nicodemus. I suppose that the author of the fourth gospel was trying to say, look, to you Jews who are continuing in your Judaism and not following our Jesus, look, one of your own leaders followed Jesus. He is a model. He is a model of what should be an example to all of you. Old Nicodemus, a rabbi, a member of the Sanhedrin, a leader of the Jewish people, a representative of the best of Judaism, the best of Israel. And he came to Jesus one night to say, what in the world is going on? Who are you? Who am I? What's up? And Jesus said, you have to be born again. Or born from above, or born spiritually. It's not so different from what I've experienced. I've been born again. I've seen things that I looked at forever and never saw before. I've had fresh spiritual insight and been able to move out of the cramped and cribbed straitjacket of a rigid orthodoxy that claimed to be the exclusive truth into the spacious grace of inquiry, of openness, of freedom. Religion needs to be reimagined so that one like Nicodemus, who was deeply rooted in the establishment, could come and be confounded by the statement that he had to be born again. Not as Jimmy Carter popularized it. Not as the TV evangelists harangue us about it. But born again with eyes to see and ears to hear, with a fresh awareness and new openness and a hunger and a thirst and an ongoing spiritual quest that's never done, but always inviting us to something more and something beautiful. Did you hear that marvelous statement of Psalm 131? O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. A certain humility and rest and trust and peace, knowing that we are woven together in the bundle of life, which consists of beautiful relationships and deep and profound meaning that causes us to see the wonder and the miracle, the glory and the joy of life, which is a gift full of grace. Last evening, I sat on the bluff and watched the sunset. And in that magnificent western sky, illumined by the globe, the sun poured its radiance across the waters, and there was a path of yellow gold. And then I went up into the loft and continued to work, and as the evening sky took over, I looked out the window to see that silver crescent of a moon next to the evening star, and noticed on the lake that the yellow gold path had become now a silver path of moonlight. And I said, "Oh my God, and it is enough."